There's a thousand further women living out there. They're all living the devil may care. Well, I'm just a devil with a lot of despair. So viva Las Vegas!
Thank you, Wayne Newton, for that fabulous intro. You're listening to Cats with the Dish. This is John Katzalamidis. I write the Cats Report in the Las Vegas Sun, Las Vegas Weekly, both those websites. I write for all the titles in Greenspun Media Group, including The Sunday, which comes out on the Sunday, except on the occasions when it comes out on
the Saturday or the Monday.
Once in a while on a Monday. Trish McCrone.
Hello.
With me once more. What's going on, baby doll?
I am literally little slap happy today because I've been having to get up. It's like 5:30 in the morning, and you know those are not my hours.
No, I
live on Wayne Newton time.
5:30 looks like. Now, tell us about, this is exciting stuff that's happened in the Newton universe.
Yes, it is.
And we're probably talked to him about it this week.
You did. You probably know more than I do.
Maybe.
Because I didn't know much because
I know. Superstar families, ladies and gentlemen, are interesting to have as friends. Tell us what happened. Tell us what's going on, Dishy, with
Okay,
with
well,
Wayne.
Apparently, about 5 weeks
no,
ago.
No, it's really happening.
About 5 weeks ago, it was worked out. I still don't know how. Maybe you know all of this. That it has been a big speculation. I've even speculated who's going to be the opening act for the Las Vegas Arena. I was not hiding anything from you. I really didn't know.
No, I know. I know you didn't know.
So it was one of those crazy things. And as it turns out, it is the local band The Killers, who
yes.
we love, and then with special guests Wayne Newton and
Shamir, who's a North Las Vegas EDM star, rising star. So we've got the Rock and Rollers. Kylie, our producer, knows Shamir. Yes.
Oh, nice.
Big deal. Okay.
we're
breaking the fourth wall of radio
I'm 23. I'm old, and I don't know Shamir.
He lives in North Las Vegas.
Oh, it's a man.
Yes.
Okay, sorry. I
it's a guy.
Okay.
And he lives near Coolio.
Oh my God, I love that. Shamir.
Coolio lives out there too.
Come on the show, Shamir.
Now, Coolio is somebody I have heard of. Anyway, so that's the lineup. And we were talking about this week. And Wayne is going to be performing A Period of Time. I interviewed him this week. And he says he's going to play for 15 or 20 minutes. That's out there. And he's going to be able to possibly perform with The Killers.
That would be
a song.
Then you do know more than
I
do.
They overlap.
Wonderful. Well, I'm really, really, really excited because we love The Killers. And it was fun because we just spent time with Brandon Flowers not too long ago before Shenandoah opened.
February.
And where basically he came out, it was for Billboard Magazine. It was very cool that Brandon Flowers and Wayne were in tuxedos and they kind of interviewed each other and did a photo shoot. And it was really, what a nice guy. And he was telling stories about how him and his brother, they would lift each other up over the wall to look over, and things like that. It was just he's such a nice guy and, very family. He's kind of that guy who's the hot front man, but is so family and not the wild guy at all. He's just a really kind individual.
Wayne told a story about when they were looking for property, I think it was last year, or no, it was a couple of years ago, whenever they were looking for property, and on the west side of Las Vegas and where Flowers lives, and Wayne saw Brandon walking with his kids on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Just walking.
I know, it's crazy.
Just passed him in his rig.
And then, we know Ronnie Vannucci. Obviously, you were there. Well, Wayne did a thing with the Killers at their studios, kind of a behind the scenes thing. That was fun.
What it was a video that was done for NME, the website and the music platform. And they were doing a tour of Battleborn Studios here in Las Vegas. What would be a typical tour? And Wayne was involved and Andre Agassi and
Carrot Top
and Jubilee.
Cirque du Soleil. And there was sort of a tiger involved somewhere.
Dirk Arthur. And it was like Ronnie and Brandon were leading this tour through. And then we turn this corner and they see Wayne is at the vending machine.
Yeah, exactly. It was really fun. And so, and then it seems like actually my sister, the president, the partner in the law firm she worked at before she married Wayne, Wayne's wife, Kathleen, the partner that she worked in the law firm was Dominic Vannucci, who just so happens is either Ronnie's uncle or cousin. I think it's his uncle.
Yeah.
And so Dominic's his uncle. So it's kind of funny. And then we're in Sundance with Wayne a couple years ago and we're walking and they're escorting us in and there's this huge line of people are going crazy. And I look and I'm like, Ronnie Vannucci's like standing in this giant line, with his beard and everything. And I was like, okay, you are the drummer for one of the coolest bands in the world. Mm-hmm. And yet you're waiting in this long line. I'm like, get your people, come with us. So that was actually the last time I saw Ronnie.
In the evolution of everything, where we are here at UNLV is where they Ronnie had arranged for the Killers to rehearse very early in their career in the music studio here. And they played at a place called Cafe Espresso Roma. They played Celebrity Theater downtown, which is on 3rd and Ogden in those days.
Yeah, it's going to be.
They are a genuine.
I cannot wait. It's August 6th, we should say. I don't know if we said that. August 6th. I'm sorry, April 6th.
April 6th.
So it's really exciting. Yeah. I can't wait. And speaking of exciting, who you booked on our show today is one of the most exciting things that's ever happened to Cats with a Dish.
Excitement abounds here on Cats with a Dish. Upcoming on this week's show is a genuine rock and roll star, rock legend. By anybody's estimation, he's the singer and guitarist from Creedence Clearwater Revival, had a huge successful solo career, and he's going to be at the Venetian next January for a series of 8 shows. His name's John Fogerty, but first we have Josh Bell with movies this week. It's Heart of the Sea, so stick around. I know we will.
Hi, this is Brad Garrett, and you're listening to Cats with the Dish.
I'll accept your resignation upon our return to port. That will be all.
It was your order to set stunsail, sir.
That decision was sound. The men needed testing.
So you send them into a storm?
That was unlucky.
No, it was bad seamanship. And blaming misfortune is just plain weakness.
Damn your impertinence! Do you know who you're speaking to?
That's Chris Hemsworth and Benjamin Walker in the high seas action adventure In the Heart of the Sea. I'm Josh Bell, film critic for Las Vegas Weekly, with a look at what's new in theaters this week. Director Ron Howard's dramatization of the actual 1820 whaling disaster that inspired the novel Moby Dick is a workmanlike, middle-of-the-road crowd-pleaser with some solid performances and a handful of rousing moments. Stacked up against one of the most celebrated novels of all time, however, it looks pretty paltry. There are a couple of thrilling set pieces featuring giant CGI whales, along with some jumbled editing and camera work, but most of the story is dull and plodding, with minimal character development. I give In the Heart of the Sea 2.5 stars out of 5. In the Heart of the Sea is this week's only new release, so it's a good time to catch up on some of the currently playing movies that are top contenders for year-end awards. Brooklyn is a lovely, old-fashioned romance set in the 1950s with an optimistic view of immigrant life and a great lead performance from Saoirse Ronan. Creed is a surprisingly effective extension of the Rocky series, a solid, rousing boxing drama that is also an unexpectedly affecting look at Rocky himself in his twilight years. And Spotlight is a riveting drama about the Boston Globe's investigation of the Catholic Church molestation scandal with an excellent ensemble cast led by Michael Keaton. All three are very much worth seeing. That's a look at what's now in theaters. Check out my reviews in Las Vegas Weekly and my blog at joshbellhateseverything.com.
Welcome back. Calling in now is the legendary singer and guitarist for a little band out of Northern California called Creedence Clearwater Revival. He is about to be a Las Vegas headliner, too, appearing at the Venetian Theater on the Strip for 8 shows beginning January 8th. That happens to be Elvis's birthday also, folks, if you need to know that. The show's called Fortunate Son, and here to talk about it is the Fortunate Son himself, the great John Fogerty. John, thank you so much for calling in.
Well, hello. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, we're looking forward to having you in our fair city.
I'm looking forward to being there very much. I'm going to enjoy this.
Yeah, I saw you perform at the opening of our great performing arts center, the Smith Center, and you were an unannounced guest that night and came out playing a Louisville Slugger guitar, which I thought it was just a Louisville Slugger at first. I didn't know what you were doing with that thing. But can you tell me what you remember about that particular night and how all that came about? Because that's a very serious and a respected venue here in Las Vegas now.
Well, yeah, I certainly was invited. I'm not quite sure the particulars, but I was very happy to be part of that show. I had a great time, and I remember noticing Jennifer Hudson and really watching her performance. Mm-hmm. I didn't get to speak to her that night, but that little crossing of paths led to her and I doing a version of Proud Mary on my latest album.
I was wondering if that was the reason that happened. Yeah, because she was definitely one of the headliners for that performance, and that sparked it. Was there any talk of you coming into Las Vegas for this type of residency at that time? How did it come about that you were tabbed to play the Venetian?
Well, I think this, of course, they invited me as mm-hmm. a Venetian. And over the years, there have been a few different suggestions, let's say. But I don't know. It never quite seemed the right time or the right situation. And this really does. So, you know, I'm very happy. I kind of jumped at the chance. Wow, that'll be a lot of fun. And as you said, the opening show is January 8th, and of course that's Elvis's birthday.
Yeah, was that by design?
I don't think anyone noticed but me.
I was wondering if anybody noticed.
Yeah, first thing I said, and so, you know, that's a good thing. It seems to be an omen.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you and Elvis are both quintessential blue-eyed soul singers there, so, you know, I think it's kind of kismet there. It's meant to be.
Yes.
What have you had a chance to see anything in that theater, John? Have you scoped it out at all and scouted it?
I've scouted it, but I haven't watched any shows there mm-hmm. In that theater yet.
It's a theater where they do a lot of these kind of mini residencies. You know, we've had Diana Ross in there most recently. We've had Tim McGraw, Faith Hill in that room. We've had Earth, Wind, and Fire did a show in that room. So what they're doing, and you're part of this apparently, is just doing anywhere between like 8, 9, 10, 12 shows and building a reputation that way. Is there any talk for you coming back and making Las Vegas sort of a recurring home the same way that like Elton John does over at Caesar's Palace and that kind of residency?
I suppose. Certainly that thought is in my head anyway. You know, I'm really looking forward to doing these shows. I mean, it's something I'm approaching with with all of my thought, you might say. It's not something I'm just sort of passing through town. I'm mm-hmm. quite interested in doing a great job. I've watched, you know, many artists through the years. Having played Las Vegas, and certainly there's a tradition, you know, starting back with Sinatra, mm-hmm. Of greatness, and I hope to live up to that.
Was there ever a point in your career, early in your career, that you thought you'd end up in Las Vegas?
Well, you had to push that button.
I know that rockers in the 70s especially saw
right.
Las Vegas
no,
as a place
a youngster,
to go and die.
You know, it seemed like the old guys that were probably my parents, music, it seemed like they looked down on rock and roll. Mm-hmm. These are people, let's see, I was 10 years younger than Elvis, and these people were more than 10 years older than Elvis. And
right.
So they weren't putting me down, they were putting Elvis and his generation down. They seemed to kind of look down their nose at rock and roll. So I didn't enjoy that. But as time has gone on, of course, you know, you move ever so surely toward that time of life where it seems like a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have so many hits in your career, both with Creedence Clearwater, all of your solo hits. How do you figure out what to perform in these Vegas shows? Are they going to be sort of a set list every night? Or are you going to change it up?
I'll just keep playing them until I run out.
Because I don't know how you can like narrow it down to an hour and a half show with everything with your history of hits.
There you go. Yeah, actually, you know, we've designed this show and getting ready for next month. The problem is cutting it down to an hour and a half or 90 minutes. But you know, it's something you, how can I say, you want to hit the highlights that everybody's expecting. Mm-hmm. And also there's songs that have emotional content, let's say, that you want to make sure that you do. And so having built that up, then, as you just said, there's still a spot for one or two songs to change, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're certainly looking at that, too.
Let me read just kind of a short list of the songs that we call. I forget who it was. An artist in your class once referred these songs, the greatest hits, as the riot songs. In other words, if you didn't play the songs, there would be a riot.
Well,
I think it was Cody Wells of Three Dog Night. I think he was the one who said that. But let me run through the list here, John, if you'd indulge me. Proud Mary, Born on the Bayou, Bad Moon Rising, Green River, Down on the Corner, Traveling Band, Up Around the Bend, and Looking Out My Back Door. That's a short list of what we've understood is going to be
played. So far, we're all good.
Those are
good. Okay.
That's the riot list. Okay, good. And is there anything, are you doing any covers?
at all?
That's something you can do also that can revolve, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been known for a few covers, like Suzy Q, which is not mine originally.
A lot of people think it is.
The Grapevine.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Another one that people think it is yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, right. Time to time, I'll do a song called New Orleans, which is probably known better as Hey, 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 Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, speaking of covers, one of the things that I always is one of my favorite performances that I've seen was Tina Turner when Ike and Tina, and she did her rendition of Proud Mary, and she gave you guys credit that this was your song.
Well,
and
that's
that
cool.
She was going to do
know, what I should do is get her over there.
There you go.
Oh, man.
But, I mean, how do you feel about when other artists like that perform your music? It's great. I mean, honestly, as she should, she gave the credit to you. But how do you feel when other artists sort of cover
well,
your
of
music?
Of course, I've been following and watching Ike and Tina Turner, for years before their version of Proud Mary. And I'll never forget the night I was riding in the car. I think it was dark out, but it was only about 6:30, 7 o'clock. Gosh, that came on the radio, and my eyes just got real big. I think I was by myself, and it started to play, and oh my goodness! And by the time I got done, I was just so happy and excited. It sounded really great, and I was just happy for Tina Turner because I'd been kind of pulling for her for years and years and years, and kind of watched other people, have their careers take off, and this seemed like a great moment for both of us.
A great catalyst. Did you not know that was being recorded and issued until that moment, John?
That's right. Yeah.
Wow.
In the music area, you don't really have to tell anybody that you're recording. You just have to certainly give them credit, on the label and that kind of thing. So it was a complete surprise at the time, and, it was one of those good surprises.
Yeah, I can just imagine what was going through your head when you heard your song being sung by... I think you had introduced that song after a while of not playing Creedence stuff by saying, I have to play this one to make sure everybody understands that I recorded it before Tina Turner did, right?
There was a moment when... Yeah, there was a time when I wasn't performing my own songs, believe it or not.
I know.
And I was on a stage in... the Palomino in Los Angeles, and Bob Dylan, actually, I was standing there on stage with Bob Dylan, George Harrison, and Taj Mahal, and they said, well, John, do Proud Mary, and I, oh, no, I'm not doing my song. And Bob Dylan turned to me, he said, you don't do Proud Mary, everybody's going to think it's a Tina.
That's what it was. That's the line. So it was Dylan who said
that. It's one of those, cool moments in my life anyway. I can still remember that like yesterday.
Oh, my God. So it was Harrison?
Needless to say, I performed Proud Mary.
Yeah, I guess that settles it. No matter what happens, you got to play. But it was Taj Mahal, Bob Dylan, George Harrison. Okay.
Wow.
Wow.
Those little-known people.
Well, can you take us through, John? I know that you've touched on something I was going to ask about anyway, and that was you were forbidden from playing your own material, primarily from the Creedence days, for quite a while in your career. How come? Why was that, and how did you get out of it?
Well, it wasn't that I wasn't forbidden technically, but in a sense, I was. I had recorded and made a lot of hit songs for Fantasy Records, and they owned all those songs. They owned the publishing.
Right.
And so they went from being, basically, well, the owner had a 5-year-old station wagon at the time that we did Suzy Q. And let's say his fortunes really sailed.
He is the fortunate son.
But he refused to give me or the guys in the band any kind of a better arrangement, And what happened was after the band broke up, he hung on to me but let the other guys out of their contract. And that was the moment at which I realized that if I just keep going forward, nothing will ever change. In other words, the same guy that's giving me a really crummy royalty rate also owns me for the rest of my life.
So for your solo, you would be doing the same thing.
Stop helping him make more money. That's how it felt to me.
So to get out of the record label, you gave up any future rights for music from Creedence?
What I did was I gave up my artist royalties, yes.
Wow.
So that I wouldn't have to give him any more songs. That's true. I did that at the end of 1980, I believe it was.
Wow, wow, wow. That's millions of dollars.
And that lasted for until finally the album The Long Road Home on Concord came out around 2005 or something. All through those years, I wasn't paid artist royalties.
But you are now for all the Creedence music? Okay, great, great.
Holy mackerel. Holy mackerel. Can you tell me, John, I'm always curious about the development of bands in your era, and I think it was Springsteen who said that when he inducted you into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that you were the best band of the late 60s. I believe he said that about Creedence.
Right. I think what he said was they weren't the hippest.
The hippest.
Just the best.
Just the best, right.
And that was...
That's a lot of bands
probably right.
In that group.
You know, I'm a little corny. I don't know every cool thing that just happened, you know, the latest. But, you know, I don't worry about that anymore much either.
That's some really, really heavy praise from a major figure in a period of time when there was
a lot
of rock and roll going on in the late 60s. That must have floored you when you heard it.
Well, you asked an interesting question. I'm not sure I have the answer to, but it sure was a fun time, at least for me in my life, you know, being, you know, loving music from when I was born, basically, and about the age of 11 or 12, deciding that's really what I want to do. And of course, growing up through all those innocent times where you play at a mother's club meeting, you know, you get to play a couple of songs or you play a little sock hop at your junior high, and, you know, you're getting older, you're learning more about music, you're getting better, and, you know, seeking advice and being in shows and just learning, you know, and growing. Always with the thought that it's leading somewhere, and the hope, of course, that it eventually will lead to a career in music, but never really quite knowing because, you know, you're a realist, or everyone tries to make you a realist.
Yeah.
And they say, you better go to college. You know, sorry, I didn't do that, but...
not too late. You can still
go back
to college.
You look around and you see a lot of people not making it, so it does give you pause. But there seemed to be at least an understandable method to it then. And I must say, you know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I know how to negotiate these treacherous waters now. I mean, it seems like there's a million more singers and bands and records, and, you know, because everybody can make a record on their iPhone.
Yeah, there's more of it, but I mean, I'm beginning to wonder what the music industry even is anymore when you can just record and issue something and people can hear it free of charge. And, you know, the record labels and major studios seem to be pushed and marginalized these days. I mean,
yeah, exactly. And I certainly have the sense, back then I had the sense that the people we heard from earned it, you know, that they got good enough that's why I'm hearing from the Supremes or Rare Earth or Led Zeppelin or the Stones, you know, because they got good enough and they stayed at it. Whereas a lot of times nowadays, I get the sense that while the people we hear, of course, are good, that there may be many, many more that are good as well, but we're just happening to see the lottery winners, you know, by some sort of fluke of luck. That one came through, and then there are many more maybe that didn't get through the lucky spot, you know?
Yeah, it seems like in the era that Creedence came up, that artistic merit and commercial success went hand in hand much more than they do today, right? Is that an accurate, like the Beatles?
Well, you know,
the Beatles
I don't know. I've seen people that I think are really great. I'm not sure I would... You know, I don't want to sound like the old grandpa saying nothing's good now.
No, yeah.
A lot of people are really great. You know, Taylor Swift is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The singers like Sam Smith or Ed Sheeran, you know.
Yeah.
Who write great.
Like that. I love their music.
I get a comparison between you and Sheeran especially, you know.
Oh, well, I sure like his music.
Yeah,
he's awesome.
He's held together. I saw him at the Rock and Rio Festival here in Las Vegas, and he was able to hold a crowd of 50,000 with just an acoustic guitar.
Good for him, sure.
And that's not...
I wish I'd been there,
relatively rare for a young artist, to be able to do that today. He was really impressive. Yep. Can you tell me, John, in talking about the development of an artist in your era, can you give me a bad gig story, like a typical when you guys were just coming up and had to, you were still in your formative years and kind of a rough night wherever you were, at the venue, at the music club, at the tavern, wherever it was, like it would indicate where you came from?
Well, there was one that it wasn't necessarily bad. It was while we were the Gollywogs. And we'd had a couple of, you might call them regional hits, mostly in Central California.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were playing a show at the Sacramento Auditorium, which is that same venue where Keith Richards touched the mic and his guitar at the same time and was shocked and knocked out.
Oh,
yeah.
Gosh.
He got KO'd.
The Gollywogs played there several times. And I used to get shocked in that same place. I didn't get knocked out, but there was something going on. But anyway, we were kind of up and coming young band, but we were on the bill with Sonny and Cher, and so we were the last act just before Sonny and Cher, and we finished our normal set, and the people were really liking us. We were the little Gollywogs, kind of a local band, but we were on the radio, so. They liked us so much that the promoter or whatever said, "Well, you guys, because the curtain had closed, said you guys can do an encore. They really love you. Go on, go do an encore." So we quickly got our game together, went out. They opened the curtain and we started doing "Walking the Dog." We got about 10 seconds into it, and suddenly the curtain closed. We just, what? What?
Wow.
What? Well, it turns out that was Cher's very first number when they would.
Oh no!
Oh, so that was on purpose.
So we didn't intend it that way, but we were sort of stealing some of her thunder, and we couldn't have that.
You steal 10 seconds worth of Cher's thunder, and then the curtains close.
Right? I love it. Now, you guys went. Speaking of you guys went through a few names. How did you end up with Credence as your name?
Well, I'll try and not make the long story, but when the new guy took over Fantasy Records, we had been named Gollywogs by the record label because they thought it would be cool and hip, kind of like Beatles and British stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then weren't you Blue Velvet or something like that for a while?
Yeah, it was a horrible name. You had to explain it to each person.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's a bad marketing ploy, if you have to explain it.
Yeah.
So the new guy took over, and he called us to his house to announce this to us, and the first thing we said was, "Can we change our name?" Because we really hated being Gollywogs.
Gollywogs.
And so then we set about thinking up names. This was sometime in October when he told us this, and on Christmas Eve of that same year, I was watching TV. There was a beer commercial the first thing was a anti-pollution commercial in black and white, and it said "Right to Clean Water, Washington." And then right after it was a beer commercial where their slogan was "It's the water," and it was in beautiful color and lush singing in the background.
Wow.
They looked enchanted, and I looked at it, something about water, and that stuck in my head. So I got going down the road on Clearwater, and kind of the rest of it spun around in my head. And within, just a couple of minutes, I think, I had come up with that name.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big improvement on the Gollywogs.
yeah, thank you.
It's the water. That's Olympia, isn't it?
I love that.
Isn't that Olympia beer? It's the water? I think that was the slogan.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I didn't know anyone would...
Now that is the connection between from you and Olympia Beer is it's the water. I had never known that.
I love that.
I want to ask you a little bit about your durability, John, and something that Paul McCartney said about 20 years ago. He said, "When you're playing rock and roll, you hit 30, you hit 40, and you hit 50, and it doesn't seem bad yet." And he's gone on to 60. Paul's 70 now. You're 70, right? Is that true? Is what he's saying true in your experience?
Well, I remember joking that when I turned 50, I said, "Well, good. At least I'm out of the awkward 40s." Because when you're like in your 50s and you're, doing rock and roll, at least people can tell you're serious about it. You've starting to enter maybe mythical proportions, right? Whereas when you're in your 40s, it's kind of like you're just hanging on too long.
Oh, my gosh. So,
there's the elder statesman kicks in at 50. Wow. All right, John. Well, I think that that is going to cover us here. You begin your run of 8 shows on January 8th, and that runs
through. Thank you very much. Yes.
Yeah. And you say you're not hip, but I feel like we're going to get you into some costumes here in Las Vegas and really jazz up the show. We're going to get you to into a wardrobe stylist and the whole thing. We're going to really vamp up this show.
Well, I'm going to I'll have to be amazed.
Yeah, you'll be in a cape and sequins and a jumpsuit and shades, the whole thing. I can't wait to see it.
I think what I've been thinking is I'll probably just wear one outfit, but I'll change guitars.
I like it.
You can have like a batting stand net behind you with different bats and as Louisville Sluggers, and that could be your shtick.
Exactly. Well, I have one of those.
Yeah, that we can make that happen. All right, sir. Well, we're really looking forward to having you here in Las Vegas, and I hope it's the beginning of a long and fruitful relationship with you, and thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
You betcha.